Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. Thank you for listening in. I'm one of your hosts for today, Ursula Rudenberg, together with my co-host, Rebecca Reuter.
KHOI had a wonderful event yesterday. We're beginning to anticipate our fifth anniversary, which is coming up this August. KHOI is a member of the Ames Chamber of Commerce, and yesterday they held a ribbon-cutting ceremony just for us to help kick off our birthday month.
Jan Williams is the Director of External Business Relations for the Chamber of Commerce, and she helped us kick off the celebration by introducing Joe Lynch, KHOI's board chair. Here's Jan.
Welcome, everybody. I'm Jan Williams with the Ames Chamber of Commerce, and you all must know that there's a party taking place here. This is a fantastic turnout. KHOI Radio is a wonderful nonprofit member of the Chamber of Commerce. They are getting ready to celebrate their five-year anniversary. It really is a labor of love for many volunteers and board members. We are going to try and cut the ribbon here in front of the banners.
Joe Lynn spoke a few minutes afterwards, after the applause. He talked about how KHOI is a true community project and how great it feels for everybody here to be serving Ames for 5 years and our excitement for the future.
This is a big deal. 5 years. Let's have a big round of applause for community radio, local, independent, volunteer-driven. There's a whole raft of people who have worked hard at doing this for more than 5 years, actually. Their hard work keeps us on the right track, and we're excited to go into our fifth year. We have a special event on August 12th to celebrate this. We're having a music event here and a party. The street will be closed off beginning at 4 o'clock. The band is a organ player from Des Moines, jazz organ, widely known, living legend indeed. Great guy. We're excited to have him. We invite everyone to come and enjoy that with us. He has a wide appeal to a wide range of folks, so invite your friends. We're going to have a great time. The last thing quickly I want to introduce is a huge variety of community and government groups come on the radio on an irregular basis and help contribute to what we're doing. Grab a brochure. This shows all the folks that bother to get their butt up here at 7 a.m. in the morning, at noon, at 8 o'clock at night, and occupy our beautiful studios and make this into a real community asset. And the creativity that is exhibited here is really quite amazing. It's something I think still fairly new to the Ames area, using local media, truly community-owned local media, to be a creative community builder. That's what we're about, building community. Well, thanks for coming. Have a snack. Take a tour of the studio. Come to our August 12th celebration.
So you heard he acknowledged us Local Talk people for getting our butts up here at 7 o'clock in the morning. So thank you, Joe. KHOI had a full house of 30 or more people here in the studio for the ribbon cutting, and we really appreciate the effort the Chamber of Commerce made in creating this party for us. The folks at the station were volunteers, programmers, board members, and members of the Chamber of Commerce, and also just some listeners, which was really great that some of you showed up and just celebrated with us because you had heard about the event. There's a group of Ames Chamber of Commerce ambassadors. They're part of the Chamber Ambassador Program. And this is a group of business people who help with the celebrations and kind of come and make you feel special. And here's a few of them.
Hannah Hoover, Northridge Village.
Cherie Wandling, Wilson Toyota.
Mary Beth Buckley, Iowa Natural Wellness Center.
Allison Walter with the Ames Convention and Visitors Bureau.
Bonnie Brown, Global State Mortgage.
Marcy Ferguson, Remax Real Estate Center.
Tammy Poolbeck, Iowa State Center.
Holly Bowman, the Iowa State Center.
Jamie Olendek, Ames Tribune.
Lisa Downs, Exit Realty.
John Hale, Hale Architecture.
Tony LaRosa, Top Flight Financial Mortgage.
Ashley Howe Expansion.
Heather Johnson with the Octagon Sanford Arts and proud neighbor of KHOI.
Pam Fleener with First National Bank.
Brenda Dreyer with the Ames Chamber and Economic Development Commission.
Gloria Betcher, Ward 1 City Council Representative and representing the downtown area. So I'd like to congratulate KHOI and thank you for helping to preserve this wonderful historic building.
Matt Kaler, Greater Iowa Credit Union.
Daryl Veggie, Story County Community Foundation.
Jim Kopic, I'm mostly here for the snacks.
Are you an ambassador?
I am new an ambassador.
Would you explain what an ambassador is?
They go to all the ribbon cuttings, and they just promote the community.
Will you give your name and where you're from?
Yeah, Bonnie Brown with Global State Mortgage.
And why are you an ambassador?
Because we believe in Ames, and we want to make it a better community for everyone. You get to see, like, come into this beautiful studio and see what Ames does have to offer.
Marcy Ferguson with RE/MAX Real Estate Center. I love Ames. I was born, raised here, been here all my life, and to support the new businesses, the anniversaries, the openings, all of that.
So you do it to support businesses?
Absolutely, absolutely.
This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, 89.1 FM. In the next half hour, we will look at two political developments that have made some concern about civil liberties, but mostly have just kind of been hard to understand completely. First, we'll talk about the request to release voter information of each state, followed by a discussion of anti-protest bills popping up in various states. On May 11th of this year, President Donald Trump signed an executive order to establish the Presidential Advisory Commission on Election Integrity. Vice President Mike Pence chairs the commission, and Kansas Secretary of State Kris Kobach serves as the vice chair. On June 28th, Kobach sent a letter to each state's secretary requesting publicly available voter information, including, if available, full first and last names, addresses, dates of birth, political party, the last four digits of Social Security number, voter history since 2006, military status, felony convictions, voters' information from another state, and overseas citizen information. Currently, 19 states are refusing to give any information, 26 plan to only give over what is publicly available, while 5 are still reviewing the letter.
Here in Iowa, Secretary of State Paul Pate responded in a way that we didn't completely understand, And others also expressed some confusion about what had really happened in Iowa. So we called the office of the Iowa Secretary of State. Mr. Pate was traveling and was thus not able to speak with us at the time. So we spoke with Kevin Hall, Communications Director for the Office of the Secretary of State, who spoke on behalf of the Secretary. We asked him to clarify and started out by asking him what request was actually made of the Office of the Iowa Secretary of State.
We received a letter from Chris Kobach asking for input for the Presidential Advisory Commission on Election Integrity. Asked for input, what changes, if any, to federal election laws would you recommend to enhance the integrity of federal elections, different things like that. And then there was also a request for public voter data.
Can you explain just in brief terms what Presidential Advisory Commission on Election Integrity is and what are we talking about here?
It's a committee that was put together by Vice President Pence. Chris Kobach, who is the Secretary of State from Kansas, is the vice chair of the commission. They have not even had a meeting yet. Their first meeting is July 19th, which I believe is next Wednesday. Why don't we wait and see what they have to say in their first meeting, and then I think we'll all know exactly what they're all about and what they plan to do moving forward.
This request for information, was it an executive order, or what was it actually?
It was not an executive order. It was simply a letter from Chris Kobach to Secretary Pate. It didn't say anything along the lines of, I demand this information. It says, I'm requesting that you provide the publicly available voter roll data for Iowa, including, if publicly available, under the laws of your state, the first and last full names of all registrants, addresses, date of birth, political party, if it's recorded in your state. Some states do provide political party affiliation, some don't. Iowa is one of those states where you can request a list that includes the political affiliation of someone. It requests the last four digits of Social Security number, if available. I mean, again, our office would never provide the Social Security information.
Mm-hmm. So what is Pate's reaction to all of this?
Well, he's the commissioner of elections, not the commissioner of politics. So it's not his job to say, well, you can't use the voter list for whatever reason. I mean, there are guidelines in state law and state rules for what you can use it for, and that includes genuine political purpose, bona fide political research, or bona fide official purpose by an elected official. Secretary of State is bound by state law to provide voter lists to anyone who requests it, and it specifically says anyone can request it, and the registrar, meaning again the Secretary of State or the county auditor, shall issue the voter list. Yes. Mm-hmm.
What defines a legitimate political purpose?
Well, the law is pretty vague, but it's basically if you're a campaign, you want a list of voters that you're able to contact. If you are perhaps a third party group advocating for a specific issue, those sorts of things. So campaigns use voter lists for, you know, basically to reach out to voters, contact them, see who's supporting their candidate, who they can rely on, and to encourage those people to go to the polls. So when it says a genuine political purpose, that's basically what it's referring to is campaigns. So it would be candidates, political parties, those are the ones who would be requesting these voter lists.
You said that the law was kind of broad as to the legitimacy of political purpose. Who decides what is a legitimate political purpose and what isn't?
Well, we look at each request on an individual basis, and if it meets the guidelines, again, those are for a genuine political purpose, for bona fide political research, or for a bona fide official purpose by an elected official. And then there's a list of requirements under there. But the lists are available to anyone, you know, but each request we'll look at on an individual basis and judge it by the merits there.
Ultimately, it's the Secretary of State who decides.
If the request is made to the Secretary of State, they can also make a request to the county auditor. Now, the auditors would not have statewide lists.
Why do you think they were requesting it at this time? Did they clarify what they were really looking for or why they were doing this?
You know, they did not say specifically why they requested it, and I don't want to put any misconceptions into their, you know, their reasoning. We have not responded to them as of yet. And in fact, on Monday, someone from commission emailed our office, and I assume all the secretaries of state around the nation, asked them not to send any data at this point because there's some legal wrangling going on, and they're waiting to hear back from a judge in regards to that. So no data is being sent from any office at this point, and we have not responded to their initial letter yet. They need to follow the proper procedures in Iowa before we would provide anything to them.
Is this kind of out of the ordinary that there is a commission like this and that a request like this is being made?
Well, I think I'm not aware of a commission specifically in this manner that has been set up before. But in terms of people requesting voter lists, that is not unusual at all. We get requests from political parties, from candidates, from media organizations, from all types of people and groups. There's a lot of misconceptions out there about what this committee is asking for. The specific request is that they said, I am requesting that you provide to the commission the publicly available voter roll data for Iowa. And what a lot of people don't understand is voter registration information is public record. Your name, your address, your history of voting, meaning what elections you have participated in, that's all public record, and anyone can request that. And in fact, it is state law that people can request that, and registrars, which are the Secretary of State and the county auditors, are required by state law to provide voter lists if people fill out the paperwork properly, follow through on the process, and they're requesting it for specific reasons.
What was Pate's public statement?
I can read it to you if you'd like.
Yeah, that'd probably be good. And it's his own words.
Sure. My office received a letter from the Presidential Advisory Commission on Election Integrity late Wednesday. Of course, this would be about 2 weeks ago, and has not yet responded to it. There is a formal process for requesting a list of registered voters as specified in Iowa code. We will follow that process if a request is made that complies with Iowa law. The official list request form is available on the Iowa Secretary of State's website, sos.iowa.gov. Some voter registration information is a matter of public record. However, providing personal voter information, such as Social Security numbers, is forbidden under Iowa code. We will only share information that is publicly available and complies with Iowa code. I am attending a national meeting of Secretaries of State later this week where the Commission's letter will likely be discussed. Paul Pate, Iowa Secretary of State, and that was about a week and a half, almost 2 weeks ago.
You said that the Secretary of State, he went to a gathering of other Secretaries of State, and this would be discussed. What happened there? How was it handled?
Well, you know, all the states received this request, and different states are reacting in different ways because states have different rules, but the majority of the states, from the way we understand it, they're going to comply with releasing what is publicly available and what they would release to anyone else who would request this information. I know there's a small handful who have said, we're not going to give you anything, but the majority of them are saying, we're not going to provide Social Security numbers or information that's private, but anything that is public record, we're bound by state law to provide that. We'll respond eventually and tell them, okay, here's how you request a list, and then we'll look at it and go from there.
As far as we understand, and correct us if we're wrong, this isn't ultimately about procedure. It's about voter fraud.
You know, to be honest with you, the commission, we don't want to put exactly what they're looking for, what their purposes and intents are. You know, that's not for us to say. That's up to them to define to the people. We do know, and I know Secretary Pate is pleased, that there are secretaries of state, bipartisan secretaries of state, that are part of this committee. Connie Lawson, the Secretary of State from Indiana, Bill Gardner, who is a Democrat from the state of New Hampshire, are members of this commission. And so we're glad to see that whatever they're working on, if they're working on elections, that there are, you know, secretaries of state, commissioners of elections involved in this, and I know those are not the only two. So if you're going to be talking about elections and voter registration, things of that manner, you really need to have the experts in the room, and that would certainly include secretaries of state.
So what I hear is Secretary of State Pate and your office in general is taking a completely kind of neutral stance and kind of seeing this commission in good faith, that this is a good faith effort to clarify things around elections, and you're reserving any sort of judgment on it.
Well, we are reserving judgment on it because, again, they have not had a meeting yet. And again, Paul Pate is the commissioner of elections for Iowa. He's not the commissioner of politics.
Any other comments you'd like to make about the whole thing?
Sure. I just, you know, there's unfortunately been a lot of misconception out there. I know in some of the emails and calls to our office, people think that their voting history, like how they actually voted in an election, is something that this commission demanded to know. And that's not the case at all. No one has that information. Nobody knows how you voted in an election, you know, who you voted for. That the ballot is secret, and we are adamant about keeping them secret. We don't have that information. Nobody has that information. So that would never be able to be made publicly available. You know, I think this has been a little bit overblown. Again, these lists are out there. People already have them. Campaigns have them. Candidates who have run for office have them, whether they're, you know, running for county commissioner or running for president of the United States. They likely have your voter data out there. It's publicly available.
But you can kind of understand if there's a commission created which is connected to the executive. Presumably, when a commission's created, it means something's going to happen. And if that commission begins asking for information before anybody even knows what the agenda is, you can understand that that would raise people's hackles or at least create a sense of great uncertainty.
Sure. And, you know, we've gotten calls and emails about this. And most people, after we explain the process to them, you know, they responded back that they feel a lot better about exactly what's being asked for and what we would provide, presumably, if the proper procedure is followed. But again, Paul Pate is the Commissioner of Elections for the state of Iowa, and the county auditors are in charge of the voter registration rolls. There's no federal commission of any kind that's going to remove an Iowan from the voter rolls. That's for up to the county auditors and the state commissioner of election to maintain those databases. So, and I can assure you, Secretary Pate will protect Iowans and make sure our elections are clean and as fair as possible. He is committed to that. He wants every eligible voter to participate in our elections. So just, you know, people can feel safe in the knowledge that your county auditor, your secretary of state are working on your behalf, but we are compelled by Iowa code to make the information public. But in terms of anyone manipulating the information, we will not allow that to happen.
Well, thank you. Thank you for taking the time to talk with us.
Glad to be of assistance. If we can answer anything else for you, just let us know.
Okay. Thanks so much.
Bye-bye.
This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm your host for today, Rebecca Reuter, here with Ursula Rudenberg. You just heard an interview with Kevin Hall, Communications Director for the Secretary of State for Iowa. Speaking about Iowa's response to requested information about voters from the Presidential Advisory Commission on Election Integrity. There is a lawsuit in process, the ACLU versus Trump. They are suing on grounds that the commission met in private without making their meeting public. We tried to get a comment from the Iowa ACLU, but they were unavailable at the time. Another occurrence that caught people's attention recently, with some concern, is a bill that was introduced this past January. Senate File 111 was introduced and co-sponsored by 9 Iowa Republicans in response to an incident on Highway 80 near Iowa City.
So this is the Iowa legislature.
Yes. The bill proposed that people who intentionally block traffic would be charged with a felony. The bill died in session, but it came along a series of other so-called anti-protest bills popping up in other states. Adam Mason is the state policy director with Iowa Citizens for Community Improvement. He's with us over the phone to help us understand what almost happened in Iowa, what's happening around the country, and what we can do about it. Hello, Adam.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on the show. So what is the ICCI's reaction to these bills?
So, you know, our members across the state of Iowa were very concerned about this legislation, this proposed legislation. As you mentioned, Senate File 111, and it actually did pass out of a subcommittee and committee and was assigned a new bill number, Senate File 426.
And what exactly did it say, the bill?
So this bill would have criminalized, essentially made protesting a felony. Specifically, it was aimed at protests that shut down roadways or highways or interstates. It was in direct response, we believe, to a post-election protest in Iowa City where, I think over 200 students and community members temporarily shut down Interstate 80 there in Iowa City.
How does this bill get introduced in the first place? Like, how does someone take an act like blocking a highway and just make a bill of it?
Well, you know, throughout history, we've actually seen these kinds of responses. Those in power tend not to like dissent. And so what we see is a handful of Republican legislators who don't like the fact that people in their communities are calling out what a lot of Iowans and a lot of Americans saw as a rigged election, you know, an election that didn't go our way, where we have a new president now who didn't win the popular vote. And so as folks were exercising their constitutional right to free speech and to protest, to assemble lawfully, these Republicans looked for ways to kind of crack down on that and essentially silence free speech.
How did the bill die? On what grounds did you see it being defeated?
Well, there was a lot of negative attention. As you mentioned just a second ago, there were bills like this popping up around the country. We've seen more and more escalation in tactics by community groups, student groups, those who are really active in pushing their agenda. Black Lives Matter in Minneapolis is a great example, and Minnesota is another place, you know, our neighbors to the north, where this kind of legislation was popping up in their state house. So ultimately, we feel like we did a good job of mobilizing support. There was a lot of great organizing amongst the folks in Iowa City that were doing the protest. And I think just a combination of negative press and community outreach to their legislators put enough pressure on legislators not to move this bill forward in either the House or the Senate.
And was there any discussion of the bill in the legislature? And if so, what was the rationale?
A lot of the rationale that we heard was that in support of the bill from Republican legislators was that these kinds of protests are unlawful or that they can be damaging to the community. One of the most cited examples that a few Republican legislators used was in the event of an emergency, you know, if an ambulance would need to get through a street or a highway that was closed by a protest, it could potentially endanger somebody's lives. That example actually happened in Minneapolis when Black Lives Matter had shut down an interstate. And because the group was so well organized and who was conducting the protest, they immediately parted the protest, allowed the ambulance to pass through again immediately, and then resumed the protest. So, you know, a lot of these kind of red herring excuses are what we heard in support of the bill. Again, we believe it's ultimately just an attempt to silence protest. It's, you know, it's something that we've actually seen here in Iowa time and time again. A similar example would be Iowa's ag gag law. You know, Republican legislators don't like the fact that community activists and environmentalists and family farmers call out the effects of factory farms on our communities and our environment. So they passed a law several years ago trying to ban taking pictures of animal abuse inside factory farms. Again, this is a tactic that we've seen all around the country as several states have passed these ag gag laws. So it's not uncommon for typically what we see is Republicans trying to silence free speech.
I almost feel like these laws within the state, they creep up and people end up thinking that this is what Republican people want. But how are people reacting to these laws, whether or not they're Republican or Democrat? Do people want these laws? Do people want to be restricted in this way?
The folks that we hear from day in, day out, ultimately want to stand up for their community. They want to stand up for what they believe in. And so I think you're exactly right, is that grassroots Iowans across the political spectrum are not in favor of these kinds of laws, you know, because the political winds are constantly changing. And so in 4 years or in 8 years or in 15 years, there's going to be folks who disagree with politicians that are in power, and they have every right to express their opinions and to assemble as they see fit. And so, you know, again, I think you're exactly right. Grassroots Iowans were not in support of this bill. And that's what we did throughout the legislative session, was really reach out to those folks and try and mobilize them, again, across the state to contact their legislators, to get out to those weekend forums in their hometown communities with legislators and let their legislators know that this isn't something that they supported.
So you're saying that the best way for listeners to stay in touch with what's happening with lawmakers is to take the time, go to these, as you say, weekend meetings, to pay attention to what's happening in their hometowns at the state level. Is there anything else people can do?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, this is one of the great things is I still truly believe in a democracy of, by, and for the people. But for that to work, it means that people have to be involved. And so, you know, the best way to fight legislation like this that seeks to keep people out of the political process is to get involved and put your feet in the street. And you can do that in a number of ways. You know, join an organization. There were lots of organizations, both local, statewide, and national, that were fighting these kinds of bills here in Iowa and across the country. So get involved with an organization. You know, get out and talk to your elected officials. We're seeing this right now on the healthcare fight, and we've seen it since January, you know, where folks are turning out a lot of times in record numbers to town hall meetings and weekend coffees with their elected officials. Really getting involved and making sure that their voice is heard. Those are some of the best ways to have a big impact. And I know it can be frustrating at sometimes because you don't feel like your elected official hears you or is responding the way you want them to. But it takes constant engagement so that, you know, I think one of the things that we like to say here at CCI is that politics can happen to you or with you. And so if you want to change the dynamic, you have to get involved and stay involved.
So, you know, the going back to the issue of protesting that was raised by the legislation, it's interesting because, you know, protesting is not only a constitutional right, it's a constitutional mandate. The Constitution tells us to do that. And so when legislation like this comes up, it kind of has the effect of finessing a blanket statement in the Constitution. It's kind of like, well, protest, but there are boundaries to how you can protest, and kind of gets into sculpting what exactly that means. So it's kind of interesting that this comes up, and I'm wondering if you have any thoughts about that.
No, I think you're exactly right. You know, this is a constitutional right. It's part of the First Amendment, the right to free speech. And, you know, for me, it just goes back to a lot of times those in power don't like dissent. And so, you know, that's the basis of our Constitution. The founders were rebelling against those in power. And so that tradition needs to continue today. But what I believe we will always see is that those with power will try and limit dissent.
Well, and what they're saying is those who are protesting are going to take it too far.
Exactly. When all of the evidence shows the contrary, right? You know, the example that I mentioned before with the ambulance, and that all like in Iowa, are always peaceful, nonviolent protests.
So you're saying you don't think that there is a big potential for protests to get out of control?
I don't believe so. You know, if, again, the question about getting involved, organizations here in Iowa, Iowa CCI has been around for over 40 years. Other organizations like the ACLU and the League of Women Voters, you know, these organizations have a longstanding tradition of citizen engagement, citizen involvement, with no history of ill repercussions or violence.
It's like age makes them wiser. The age of the organization makes them wiser.
Well, experience.
There we go.
You know, it was I witnessed a protest of the New York War Resisters League, and they staged a protest. And while they were staging a protest, they all other members of the league stood around in a circle around the protesters, and all in unison said, "NYPD is the New York police." They in unison they all said, "NYPD, listen up." And then they would recite all in unison the First Amendment. And it was a really interesting thing to watch. And it was a very highly disciplined, you know, protest. And the police listened. You know, they were, I don't know, it had an effect on the whole situation. It kept everything under control. So that's a very old protest group. So you're right. experience does lead to discipline. But thank you so much for, it's an interesting topic and, really interested to hear your input on it.
Yes, thank you.
Adam, how can people learn more about ICCI?
Sure, you can visit us on the web at iowacci.org, and our sister organization, cciaction.org. Iowa CCI specializes in grassroots organizing on a wide range of issues, and CCI Action is our more political wing that does the state house lobbying we've been talking about. You know, just one quick last reflection is, it's interesting to me that, you know, that we're talking today about bills to stifle essentially constitutionally guaranteed rights. You know, we spent the last few minutes talking about protest bills, but even the attempt to limit our constitutional right of voting, which you opened up the hour with. You know, these challenges are threats to the very root of our democracy and what makes our country work. And so I appreciate you taking time today to shine a spotlight on these issues.
Thank you. Well, thank you for joining us, Adam. And we hope to have you again on the show someday. Thanks for joining Local Talk.
Thank you.
KHOI Community Radio. I'm one of your hosts today, Ursula Rudenberg, together with Rebecca Reuter. And we're speaking with Adam Mason, who is the State Policy Director for ICCI.
Iowa Citizens for Community Improvement.
Thank you.
There we go. Happy Friday, everyone.
I can never remember exactly what all those C's and I's are. Anyway, thank you, Adam, for speaking with us. We now are joined by Mary Rankin. Mary is the ISU and Ames Director of Sustainability here. And welcome, Mary. And you have brought a guest with you.
I have. I have the wonderful and amazing Susan Goyazda with me from the City of Ames.
Well, that's a great welcome. Thank you. Good morning, everyone.
So what are we going to talk about? This is Mary's regular monthly slot to talk about sustainability in Ames, which is always really very interesting. So let's get started.
Oh, thank you. No, well, it's interesting because we've got a really great project coming to our community.
Do tell.
Through the City of Ames. It's a new EcoSmart program called SunSmart Ames, and it's about bringing a community solar project to our community.
And it's rising on the horizon, so to speak.
It really, truly is. And the community has, has a great opportunity to assist us in helping it rise on our horizon.
Okay,
actually,
so explain.
This program. So
let the sun shine.
Yes, absolutely. Well, we were hoping that that Don Kalm would be with us today, and also we invited Steve Wilson. Neither one of them were able to join us today, but these guys certainly are available at any time to answer questions, and we'll talk about a couple of public informational opportunities here in a minute. But basically, this is something that it was a grassroots effort in our community. Number of individuals and groups were interested in getting a community solar project in Ames, getting more renewable energy, and having it something that would be basically available for everyone to be a part of and everyone to enjoy. And I say that because, you know, as a resident, you can choose to put, you know, solar panels on your property, in, you know, on your home, those sorts of things. But it's a considerable investment. And also everyone just doesn't necessarily have the ability to do that, depending upon where you may live. Mm-hmm. This is an opportunity that everyone can take part in providing a renewable energy source to our community. And it's based off of a similar program that took place in Cedar Falls, has taken place in Cedar Falls, very well received and very well supported. And basically the idea is that, I don't know, you might refer to the purchasing into the program. It's an opportunity to purchase into the program. You might say, well, you're purchasing shares. However, we have gotten various pieces of feedback to say that may not be the best term. So mm-hmm. we are referring to it as purchasing power packs into our community solar project.
Okay. So break that down for us.
Well, so basically what it is it's based upon we have a how we're designing it right now. It's a 1.5 to 2 watt mega to 2 megawatt system. And what we're offering to folks is that they can do a one-time investment of looking at purchasing a part of the array that would provide that 1.5 to 2 megawatt. And so
I guess you could look at it as you're sort of purchasing your own panel or part of a solar panel. You buy in and you purchase a power pack. It's a percentage of energy produced.
So you're buying a piece of the whole object, so to speak.
Your little piece of the farm.
Yes.
Right.
Kind of like a CSA mentality.
It's a co-op kind of thing. Yep. Mm-hmm.
So what you get in return is energy or money?
You are getting the way it would be reflected is you would most likely get a credit on your bill. And it's a long-term commitment. It's not just a few months or even a few years. It's a 20-year term.
When you say it's a long-term, what does that mean? Are you saying that that credit won't show up for a while?
No, it's if you were looking at how long you might be able to share that percentage of power generated, you would be looking at a lifespan of about 20 years for the equipment, and so we believe the credit would be extended from the day that we start out to about 20 years.
So let me get this right. There's the farm or the mm-hmm. solar panel in this case, mm-hmm. which is how big?
It will cover about 8 acres.
So it's a big panel covering 8 acres?
Multiple panels.
Sure. Yeah. So kind of picture kind of like a wind farm, like with a mm-hmm. lot of panels sitting mm-hmm. out in yeah. the field somewhere.
And you see solar farms too. So, mm-hmm. I mean, it's the same idea yeah. related to that.
Mm-hmm. And then one of those panels will have been financed by you.
Yep. You are agreeing to purchase the power produced by that one panel.
And then as that panel works, every month or whenever you mm-hmm. pay your bill, mm-hmm. you see a reduction
right.
in your bill because your panel has provided a certain amount
right.
of energy.
But let me kind of ground you in that. That credit could be pennies to maybe a dollar or so. It's not a huge credit. It's going to – what we tell people is this isn't like investing in the stock market. This isn't an investment opportunity if you're looking for a defined return.
So this is more an investment if you want to contribute to sustainable energy in our community.
I love that.
Exactly.
That is mm-hmm. exactly why you
and
would do this.
And our sustainable future.
Yeah.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Yeah, because you want to feel that you are doing something for the environment. And if you wanted to purchase additional power packs, and we're guessing that a power pack might run about $500, it's a very small – at this point, a power pack would provide a very small percentage of your monthly power. Mm-hmm. So you would have to buy multiple power packs to make a significant dent in your utility bill.
Offsetting your own.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The entire collective effect of this solar farm, so to speak, what impact will it have on our utilities needs?
Well, it's 1.5 to 2 megawatt on the busiest day, on the hottest day, on the most significant day of electric production in Ames, we hit 130 megawatts.
And how much will this affect?
This is 1.5 to 2.
Uh-huh.
Now, that's on the very – that's a record. That's a peak record. A typical day is much lower than 130. So you're looking at 1.5 to 2 megawatts as opposed to a typical production day of, I think it's 50 to 60 we might be doing.
So this isn't a hugely significant shift in energy sources.
It's a start. And again, we have wind, and we have 36 megawatts of wind. So, and again, wind is, I can't tell you every day we have 36 megawatts. We have the ability to purchase 36 megawatts every day. Today, the wind isn't, you know, there's not a huge breeze out. So,
so it's a diversification of sources.
Exactly. We have a diverse portfolio of energy production, so we can draw from those sources that are the best providers for that day. Mm-hmm. And that is, interestingly enough, very much like a market where we have people watching weather conditions and looking to where is the cheapest energy and where we can buy in and lock in a day ahead. So
can anyone with an account with Ames Utilities buy into this?
Yep.
So anyone with an apartment, you
Absolutely.
Don't have to be a homeowner.
No.
Right.
Okay.
That's one of the benefits of it because we know a lot of renters are interested, but it's not going to work with their situation to install solar. Mm-hmm. So this is the perfect opportunity.
Right.
So it's enlarging the menu of options for where to get energy for the city, given
most definitely
given whatever conditions.
Well, I think the best thing is that people who really feel strongly that they want to say, I support sustainable energy. I mean, right now, wind is not something you can purchase. If we have it, we use it. If it's not available, we don't have it. If you say, I'm committed to solar, you're every day committing to solar and you've bought in. And so we want to celebrate that, and this is a great way to do it.
And where is the farm going to be?
There are two locations we're looking at right now.
The primary location, the one we're really hoping for, is just to the west of Sam's Club, and north of the Ames Municipal Airport. And the north of the airport is kind of the key. It has to have FAA approval, and we are going through the process. It's getting closer and closer to We're feeling optimistic, but we don't have approval yet.
FAA is?
Federal Aviation Administration. And it's about glare because these are glass panels. And as airplanes come into the airport, you can't have anything that might obstruct vision. The second location is closer to Hunziker Youth Sports Complex. The property is much more rough terrain. The nice thing about the site near Sam's Club is that it's a field right now and it's being farmed and it's flat. The other site closer to Hunziker Youth Sports Complex will require a lot of fill. There's some scrub trees and things that would need to be cleared. And so that would require a little bit more work. We've had solar farm developers in. They're much more excited by the flat terrain than the other one. But we can make either one of them work.
And it also allows us possibly for expansion beyond what we're currently looking at. In some initial discussions with folks in the community, there's been interest in, okay, we do this, and then how do we build onto it? So we're also trying to be very mindful of this not just being a one-time thing, but looking at how our community is interested and wants to invest from here.
Mary, if somebody wants to find out more about this, where do they go?
Well, we have a couple of really great opportunities coming up actually in the next couple of weeks where we're going to be having some public workshops at the Ames Library. One will be at 7 o'clock on Tuesday, July 18th. And then we're also having two on July 26th, which is a Wednesday, one at 11 a.m. and one at 7 p.m. And this will allow you to ask questions, find out more information. But there's also information, Susan, there's a press release that just came out, but is there also information I hadn't checked recently on the City of Ames website? I'm sure there is.
Yeah, we try to keep that updated. We're a little bit behind, but we'll get on that right now. cityofames.org/solar. We'll try to get updates on that. And again, the workshops is a terrific opportunity to get some information and that we have people we know are ready to commit. And we'll have letter of intent forms so you can actually say, hey, I'm ready. We need to get buy-in for this to happen. We need to sell off about 80% of the power packs before we know that we can move forward because it needs to be supported by those people who have asked for it. And so it's a process. And I'd say the feedback has been very, very positive. I feel really great about this project.
Mm-hmm. Most definitely. From a sustainability standpoint, too, you know, we always talk about the environmental, the social, and the economic, and certainly this touches all of those components. Mm-hmm. Economic-wise, while there is a cost to putting this in, there's also a considerable cost we have to look at, yearly, annually, as we look at demand placed on our current power plant. And so, you know, that's balancing an investment in expansion of capacity of our current power plant versus, as Susan mentioned, the diversification of our portfolio.
On the other hand, it's really a continuation of a trajectory that was started by our power plant of sustainable resources. And it's kind of a natural continuation of that vision that started in the 1970s.
Well, that's very, very true. And I think that goes to give a lot of credit to our community and how we have been very invested in looking very thoughtfully, creatively, happy Friday, creatively and strategically over the years.
Good to know we're not the only ones. So, Mary, what else do we have before the show ends?
At the end of the month, we have Rummage Rampage coming up. And so Susan and I have been very involved in Rummage Rampage, and we wanted to Rummage Rampage, yes.
go ahead.
That's when tables and chairs
get
on a rampage.
In a herd of crazy animals.
So we had our first annual event last year. It was successful beyond what we imagined it to be. And so we're doing it again this year. And this basically is an opportunity if you're moving out, if you're moving in, if you're just cleaning out, if you say, gosh, we really could use a few more things. This is really an event for the entire community. Definitely allows us to keep those more creative and unique lawn ornaments off of lawns around this time of the year when we switch between leases and get usable
such
items.
Such as couches,
yes.
Mattresses.
Oh, we
and
saw
tables.
It all last year, didn't we?
Yeah.
But it allows those things that still have use to get to homes that can use them. And so through this event this year, we're actually extending it an extra day. So we'll start this year on the 28th of July. That will just be a drop-off day. Folks can certainly come in and look at items that we have, but no shopping until the next day. And then Saturday through Tuesday, not only will we have sales, but we'll also allow people to continue to drop off items. And then on our last day, which is Wednesday, August 2nd, it will just be half-price sales to move the additional items.
Great opportunity to declutter your house. There's actually
Most
a truck
definitely.
That will come for a small fee. And,
that is correct, yes.
We'll pick up your couches, your desks,
right.
All that stuff. And great stuff to be seen. Last year I saw an exercise machine, which kind of went for a few dollars. Beautiful equipment. So there's good stuff there.
Very good stuff. And in fact, even we did get in one exercise machine that wasn't as beautiful, but somebody came and snatched it up and said, my goodness, I need parts for the one I have at home, and this will be great, and nobody has the parts anymore. And so there's just these really very unique finds that people come across at the event.
Plus, it's really great seeing a parking ramp turn into a furniture store. It's a great visual.
What do we call it?
Rummikers?
Rampikers.
Rampikers, I'm sorry.
I think that's probably trademarked. I never said that.
Does it that's sound awesome. Like another one? I don't know. We just encourage people to come and look for items that can be donated. They'll go to, obviously, a good cause because all the proceeds from this. So we have 14 different nonprofit organizations that are signed up to provide volunteer service this year. And all of the proceeds from the event go back to those nonprofit organizations. So no money to the city, no money to the university.
That's a great – and we just want to celebrate the partnership here between the City of Ames, between Iowa State University – the ramp, we don't get charged. We don't charge for that. Nobody is making any funds off of this.
Right.
It's all donated. So it's terrific. It's just a fabulous event.
Okay, well, thank you, Mary, and thank you, Susan.
You're welcome. Let me just say, more information is on the City of Ames website. If you do just a quick look for Rummage Rampage, even if you put Rummage in, and it's right on the front right now, exactly. To sign up to volunteer, we still have open spots to volunteer that you can support these nonprofit organizations. You go to the Volunteer Center of Story County website, so vcstory.org. That's also where you can click to sign up to have a truck come and pick up items for a small fee.
Okay, great. And this is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I've been Ursula Rudenberg with Rebecca Reuter, your host for today. Thank you for joining us. And this has been Mary Rankin, ISU and Ames Director of Sustainability, together with Susan Guiazda,
Information Officer.
Public Information Officer. Thank you. Thank you, Susan. Earlier in the show, we spoke with Kevin Hall, Communications Director for the Secretary of State, Adam Mason, State Policy Director for ICCI, and some of the wonderful business ambassadors from the City of Ames, led by Jan Williams from the Ames Chamber of Commerce. We thank them for the ribbon-cutting ceremony, and they held in honor of our fifth anniversary. Our show was engineered by Rebecca Reuter.
And Marin Ellis.
Yes. Woo. Welcome, new engineer. And stay tuned for Democracy Now! At 8 a.m. and Morning Masterpiece at 9 a.m. And remember that you, the listener, are what makes KHOI meaningful and possible. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you again on the radio.
Funding for KHOI is made possible in part by the Ames Chamber of Commerce. In the heart of Ames, the Ames Main Street Farmers Market brings local food and fun. Located between the 300 and 400 blocks of Main Street, including Tom Evans Plaza, the Farmers Market provides fresh local fruits, veggies, meats, breads, handcrafted goods, live music, and family entertainment every Saturday.